Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear part two of a great 1994 talk by Michael Parenti, The Costs of Empire. 20 years later, it's still all true and nothing has changed. In a nutshell, Parenti argues that empire isn't about nationalism, it's about class and economics. Empires are ruinously expensive, but the expense is paid by the 99% in order to make the 1% even richer. Today, Parenti shows the many, many different costs of empire that we, the normal people, are forced to bear. Time is short, so I will stop talking now. Here is Michael Parenti.
People who think of empire solely as an expression of national interest rather than class interest are bound to misinterpret the nature of empire. Then they end up by saying, we are expansionists. None of us are expansionists. How many of us, raise your hand, were out there demonstrating, we want more war, we want more intervention, we want more corporate finance expansionism in the third world? How many of you did it? You see? I proved it right there. George Kennan describes U.S. expansionism at the end of the 19th century as a product of popular aspiration. The American people, quote, simply liked the smell of empire. So when people start writing like that, you know they're really throwing the stuff around. You know, it's really a lot of hot air. Two liberal writers, Buell and Rothschild, and progressive, who commented, the American psyche is pegged to being the biggest, best, richest, and strongest, and that's why we do it. When a third world nation, be it Cuba, Vietnam, Iran, or Nicaragua, spurns our way of doing things, our egos ache. Is that right? Did you get that? Did you get an aching ego when you heard that some country was trying to develop its own independence? I mean, these countries do more than spurn our ways. They move towards social orders that directly threaten multinational corporate interests. Americans do not support this empire. In fact, Americans are seldom consulted or informed about covert actions or military interventions. On the rare occasions they are informed, when it's an overt, massive intervention like the invasion of Panama, let's say, or Iraq war, they have usually opposed intervention or have not given very enthusiastic support. Opinion polls during the Vietnam War show that the U.S. public wanted a negotiated settlement and a withdrawal. They even supported the idea of a coalition government with communists, even if the communists proved too victorious and would have won all the elections. They supported the idea of elections. Well, then who then does U.S. policy represent? Even take the Gulf War. Even the public's super patriotic yellow ribbon binge was not the cause of the war. It was a response to the jingoism. It was a response to the incredible media hype. Even as late as September of 1990, just before the aerial war started, a majority of Americans supported a negotiated withdrawal by Iraq from Kuwait, which, by the way, the Iraqis were exploring and willing to consider. And you remember Bush said, we give them only a week. No army could go in a week. And then, of course, he attacked as they were leaving. We don't go to war because the people just want that war. It wasn't true in the Gulf War. It wasn't true in 1898. What are the costs of empire to the American people? If you're an unemployed worker whose plant has just moved to Hong Kong, the first thing that might come to mind is the number of jobs that our empire costs us. As early as 1916, Lenin pointed out that at an advanced stage, capitalism would export not only its goods, but its capital, not only its products, but its entire production process. And that's exactly what's happening today. Most giant American firms export their capital, their technology, their factories, and their sales networks, and our jobs. Over the last 20 years, American firms have more than tripled their total outlay in the third world. U.S. capitalism is now producing 8 times more abroad than it exports. Many firms have shifted all their manufacturing activities to foreign lands. All the cameras sold in the USA are made overseas. Just about all the tape recorders, radios, bicycles, VCRs, typewriters, computers, and TV sets. 1 out of every 3 workers employed by U.S. national companies is now in a foreign country, and that process is continuing. Americans are also victimized as taxpayers and consumers. The multinationals can juggle their books from one country to another and pay almost no taxes, show high productivity in a low-tax country, low productivity in a high-tax country, and the like. The billions of dollars that they get written off, the royalties they have to pay on oil, for instance, gets written off as tax credits, not a tax write-off. I mean, not a deduction. It's not a deduction you make before you figure your taxes, a percentage of your taxable income. It's a tax credit, the bottom line. At the end, they can deduct it right from the taxes they have to pay to the U.S. Treasury. And every dollar, every billion and billion and billion that they don't have to pay is money that we have to make up either in a debt structure or by direct taxation. The goods made abroad by super exploited labor are, by the way, sold at as high as possible price on U.S. markets. You could hear people say, well, maybe I get a break as the consumer. They go abroad, but they produce those goods more cheaply, and I get to buy them more cheaply. That's not true. Now, come on, now be real. Be grown up. It's amazing people you run into, the kind of goo-goo baby-like thinking they have about the people up there in power, hoping that they'll be benign to us, you know. Maybe they're doing this for me. They're doing it for you? You think they went all the way to Indonesia for you? You think Nike has closed every single one of its factories in America and went to Indonesia, where they pay these young women in compounds, which amount to slave labor, they pay them 10 and 12 cents an hour? You think they did that for you? No, because when those shoes, which the final production cost is $7, when those shoes get back stateside, they sell them for $134. They don't go there for you. They go there for themselves to widen that margin, to get cheap labor costs so that they can then make more profits. When they go down to Haiti and employ people for $1 a day, and that radical President Aristide wants to raise the minimum wage to $2. And the World Bank got him against the wall, said, you're going to go back, but you just drop that stuff about minimum wage and those crazy radical ideas. It costs 10 cents to make a baseball in Haiti. No, I'm sorry, wait a minute. 12 cents. It costs 12 cents to make a baseball. They stitch those baseballs in Haiti, which then sell here in the U.S. for $10 and up. What's the markup on that, 12 cents to $10? How many 1,000%? Even take off for transportation costs, whatever else. And nor do those overseas investments bring any great benefits to the people of the third world, as I said. You know, a lot of those investments lead to a worsening condition. The Brazil miracle of the 1960s, where Brazil's investments in products and exports and everything else went up, 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 and they said, oh, the prosperity coming to Brazil, that increase came with an increase in poverty. That as that land went for cash crop exports, coffee, sugar, beef, it was that much less land to grow rice and beans to feed the people. So there we now have explained a mystery. How in the last half century investment in the third world has increased so dramatically, and so has poverty. It's no mystery once you look at it in a little detail and just unpeel it. The same has been true of investments in Central America, the Philippines, Africa, and elsewhere. And then there are environmental costs. For years now, the poisonous pesticides, the hazardous pharmaceuticals that are banned in this country have been sold by their producers to third world nations where regulations are weaker or non-existent. And these poisons continue to cripple workers in the American chemical plants where they're made, and they reappear on our dinner tables in the fruit, vegetables, meat, and coffee that we import. And these pesticides now, we see, may be the cause of so much breast cancer in women and prostate cancer in men. With the passage of GATT, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, when I was a kid, I used to watch the old George Raft gangster movies. A GATT was a gun that somebody held to your head and said, you do what I want, and you give me your money, whatever else. GATT is exactly that. It is really something even more pernicious than that. It's a circumvention and end run, a global coup d'etat against any kinds of popular sovereignty, any protections that we might have. It sets up an autocratic World Trade Organization that can make all decisions regarding environment laws, labor laws, consumer laws. It legitimates the importation of products made by child labor. We have a law banning products for child labor. It wouldn't work on the GATT. That would be a non-tariff trade barrier. It undermines all sorts of public services as being unfair competition to private companies and the like. This is part of the price that we're paying from the internationalization of global capitalism. The chemical toxins and industrial effusions that pour into the world's rivers, oceans, and the atmosphere by fast-profit, unrestricted multinational companies operating throughout the Third World, devastating the lands with mining, timber companies, agribusiness. This is seriously affecting the quality of the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat. I mean, it's all one atmospheric envelope. It all kind of starts circulating around. Ecology doesn't know any national boundaries. When companies cut down rainforests in Central America, South America, and Southeast Asia, turning lush jungles into scraggly desert, that affects the quality of the air that's available in the whole world. 25% of our prescription drugs are derived from rainforest plants. Rainforests are the winter home for millions of migratory North American songbirds. The wonderful, great, glorious collection of North American songbirds, amazing species that we have, are dying out. They're going down in numbers dramatically. These birds are not just aesthetically pleasing, they are essential for pest control. The fewer birds, the more pests. The more pests, the more spraying and insecticide we do. The dumping of industrial effusion and radioactive waste may also be killing our oceans. If the oceans die, so do we, since they produce most of the Earth's oxygen. Over half the world's forests are gone compared to earlier centuries. The forests are nature's main way of removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Today, the pollution buildup is transforming the chemical composition of the Earth's surface, accelerating the greenhouse effect, and also causing a variety of climatic destabilizations, and also depleting the ozone layer. Additional costs to the environment are inflicted, by the way, the single biggest polluter on the environment in the U.S. is the U.S. military. It's used millions of acres of land at home and abroad for bombing runs and maneuvers. It causes long-standing damage to vegetation and wildlife. It contaminates the air, the soil, and the groundwaters with tons of plutonium, solvents, lubricants, lead, and all sorts of other kinds of toxic wastes. It has about 9,000 military specifications that call for ozone-destroying chemicals. It produces 90% of our radioactive waste. It stockpiles thousands of tons of lethal biochemical agents. In other words, one of the greatest dangers to the security and well-being of the U.S. public and to the planet itself is the U.S. military. Another cost of empire is the toll taken on enlisted ranks within the military. Military personnel are repeatedly killed in transport accidents, firing exercises, maneuvers, and other readiness preparations. About 2,000 non-combat deaths a year. 21,000 Americans have been killed in the military by accident in the last 10 years. 21,000, that's quite a number. You could drop that rate, you could cut that rate by two-thirds by cutting the military by two-thirds. That's my plan. How you could just immediately save, you could immediately save, look at that, you could immediately save 1,500 lives a year. If you cut the military, well, that would be by three-fourths. That's all right. Three-fourths. Thousands of Army veterans exposed to nuclear tests after World War II, now dying of cancer. That one is very fascinating, because then you get the argument of anachronism, the presentist argument, which is you cannot judge the actions of that day by today's standard. We know now. We didn't know those things then. We didn't know that radiation caused cancer. Well, if you didn't know in 1945, when you put those GIs in those shallow trenches, just a few hundred yards from zero ground, that would cause cancer, why were you and the other brass and the other army officers 2 miles back in lead-lined containers watching the thing from back there? Why weren't you in the trenches with the boys there? And why didn't you walk across the hot ground with them after the explosion? They knew. They know the radiation. They know when they test people for radiation and inject them with these things. They know what the hell they're doing. We now see, by the way, that the Gulf veterans, thousands, tens of thousands of them, get seriously taken ill. from something that happened there. There are other ways the empire fights back. The narcotics that victimize whole segments of our population are shipped in through secret international cartels linked to CIA operatives. The CIA was active in the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia in the narcotics trade. They actively supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, who were the biggest, today now the biggest exporters of opium and heroin from Afghanistan, the so-called Mujahideen freedom fighters. And also from Latin America, the cocaine, the CIA is implicated. That's not a conspiracy theory. That's not some coup. There are at least three congressional committees that have found, including Senator Kerry's committee, that have found that CIA operatives in substantial numbers have been involved in narcotics trade. And you got these pilots who are going back and say, yes, Senator, I flew down with a plane load of guns and I came back with a plane load of cocaine. And I had no trouble getting in. And there's maybe 400 or 500 planes that come in every year. And say, well, you know, it's such a vast frontier. How could we stop these planes? The sky is so vast. Who knows where they're going to land? Can you imagine, Dick Gregory said, can you imagine if there were 500 planes of Russian spies coming in every year? They wouldn't be able to stop them or find them? The cost of the Vietnam War, let me just give you this example, including veterans' benefits and hospitals, interest on the national debt, and the like, comes to $518 billion. The economist Victor Perlow pointed out, by the end of the Vietnam War, inflation had escalated from 1% a year to 10%. The national debt had doubled. Unemployment had doubled. Real wages started on their longest decline in modern history, American history. The U.S. export surplus gave way to an import surplus. And so the Republic pays for the costs of the empire. There were human costs, too, in Vietnam. 2.5 million Americans had their lives interrupted. Many of them came back very shattered, very broken. 48,000 of them came back in bags. 300,000 were wounded, a good number with 100% disability. 55,000 have died since returning home because of suicides, addictions, alcoholism, etc. Tens of thousands have attempted suicide. African American and Latinos paid a disproportionate cost, suffering almost twice as high a rate in combat casualties. And that's no accident. That's not because the African American and Latino soldiers just had to pick up the gun and run ahead of everybody else. It's because they were put up in the most dangerous positions disproportionately. And also because they were in the army disproportionately. It's economic conscription. It's a voluntary army, but it's economic conscription. Who goes in? It's the guys who don't have many economic opportunities elsewhere, so they end up in the army. It's about the best break they can get, and that's why the casualties of those two ethnic groups were so high. Military spending has created record deficits, a runaway national debt that causes the government to borrow more and more money in shorter terms and growing interest, so you go deeper in debt just in order to service the debt. Almost 50 cents of every tax dollar we pay now goes for military spending and paying the interest on the national debt. I mean, you don't get anything for it. A debt that's paid to rich creditors at home and abroad. The U.S. used to be the biggest creditor nation. It is now the largest debtor nation after the Ronald Reagan, between Reagan, Bush, and Slick Willie, it's been good $4 or $5 trillion have been spent on the military. An incredible spending binge. Most of our financial woes can be ascribed to military spending, and also to the cuts initiated on behalf of rich corporations and individuals over the last 10-15 years. Greatest sums are spent for the development of the Navy's submarine rescue vehicle than for occupational safety, public libraries, and daycare centers combined in all of U.S. federal spending. The cost of military aircraft components and ammunition kept in storage, just the stuff that's kept in storage by the Pentagon, not used, is greater than the combined allocations made on behalf of pollution control, conservation, community development, housing, occupational safety, and mass transportation. The total expenses of the legislative and judiciary branches and all the regulatory commissions come to less than 1% of the Pentagon's yearly budget. Newt Gingrich has got a great plan. They propose to cut the entire Food Stamp Act, $25 billion. The Women's Infants Children Nutrition Program, the best dollar the federal government spends for very poor families, where you prevent malnutrition and you prevent children being born malnutritioned and brain damaged and everything else. We probably end up saving money on it. It has the grand sum of $3 billion. We're going to cut it out completely. And they're also going to cut the school lunch programs that feed about 15 million children in America, millions of whom that's the only square meal they get in the whole day. We're going to cut it all out. And they're going to save the grand sum of $32.6 million, which is almost identical to the development cost of a new vertical takeoff Osprey assault plane, which Newt Gingrich wants to revive and put back in the defense budget. All of that for this vertical takeoff plane. See, I'm trying to give you an idea of what, I don't think Americans have a proper notion of how much we spend on the military and what really goes into it. 70% of all federal scientific and technological research and development funds go to the military. And very little of that has spin-off effect for the civilian market. In fact, in the technological areas where military spending is the highest, those are the very areas where the U.S. has lost the most ground in terms of trade and sales. Furthermore, Americans must endure the neglect of environmental needs, the financial and social decay of our cities, our transportation, education, and healthcare systems, the frightful social and psychological costs, the discouragement and decline of public morale, the anger, cynicism, and suffering of the poor and the not-so-poor, the militarization and violence of popular culture, the application of increasingly authoritarian solutions to our social problems, the utter impoverishment of political discourse, so that all these questions that I've been dealing with and talking about here, all the vital questions of political economy and human need are just not dealt with. Instead, we hear about crime and we hear about prayers in the schools, you see. That's Gingrich's big plan, isn't it? To have prayers in the schools. In schools, throughout this country, schools where children often don't have textbooks, where they may go and have 18 substitute teachers in 1 month, don't even have a regular teacher. Schools where you'll find 80 kids jammed into one classroom. Schools where you'll have 6 classes going on in the gymnasium with no wall dividers, where the kids can't even concentrate and hear each other. Schools where they don't even have pencils and papers. This guy's worrying, getting us concerned about prayers in the schools as the issue. And the media then focuses on prayers in the school. What kind of a prayer would it be? How much time would it be? And the like. And this is what occupies our time and distracts us. What we are witnessing, brothers and sisters, is the third worldization of America. I called it that back in 1989 when I gave a talk in Berkeley. It was George Bush and Voodoo Economics, I called it, and I said, we are moving toward, their goal is the third worldization of America, because their goal is that around the whole world, to get masses of people working harder and harder for less, so that they can have more and more. And what we see is just that. More and more luxury cars on the street, more people on the street. A dramatic growth in millionaires and billionaires. The return of tuberculosis and diseases caused by severe protein and calorie deficiencies that are usually seen only in the third world. Rising rates of infant mortality in poor areas. So when we talk about poor nations and rich nations, we mustn't forget that there are millions of poor in the rich nations and there are thousands of rich in the poor ones. There's a verse by Bertolt Brecht, and it goes as follows. There were conquerors and conquered. Among the conquered, the common people starved. Among the conquerors, the common people starve too. And so that's what we have. The lives and treasures of the people are squandered so that the patricians may pursue their far-off plunder. A party for Caesar, a party for Pompey, but where is the party for the people of Rome? And the point to remember is that these social conditions are not irrational. They're not aberrations of a rational system. They're the rational outcomes of a basically aberrational system. They are the outcome, one that organizes the labor and the resources of society around the process of accumulating as much capital for a few powerful interests at the expense of many at home and abroad, and at the expense of almost every human social value. What we have to do is appeal to the U.S. public and to people to resist the victimization by empire. Not to say to them, oh, don't be aggressive, oh, don't be defensive, oh, love your enemies, oh, if they threaten us, take the risk and try to be friendly to them. People get scared. When they feel their security is in jeopardy, they will be ready to support any kind of outrageous and horrible action. We have to appeal then to something much stronger and something much more vital and more immediate, which is their self-interest. Not their selfishness, but their self-interest. That is, the difference between selfishness and self-interest. Selfishness is you just take what you want at the expense of anybody else. Self-interest is when we see that we all have a common interest in this thing, and where really does our interest lie. We've got to understand, make people understand that the gargantuan global military apparatus they now grudgingly support at such immense cost does not serve their interests, and that to abolish it will not leave them prey to some foreign adversaries. We've got to help them understand that this empire, we've got to let them know or get out the message that this empire is paid for by their blood, sweat, and taxes, that it has nothing to do with patriotism, it has nothing to do with protecting them or protecting less fortunate peoples abroad. It has everything to do with victimizing them in order to feed the power and profits of the few. To lay down the sword and use our labor and national treasure for the peaceful reconstruction those so desperately needed at home and abroad is not to become a weak nation, it's to become a strong nation. Those people who say, well, you have a conspiracy theory that these people are running the whole thing. I think of this cartoon poster my son Christian has up on his wall. It shows two steers in the meadow, and one of the steers has an anguished look on its face, and it's saying, oh, I just discovered how hamburger is made. And the other steer is looking with a kind of a superior smirk and saying, oh, there you go, you leftist paranoids with your conspiracy theories. Well, we have got to, lest we all end up as hamburger, we have got to shout out and say all these things, as outrageous as they may sound, as iconoclastic as they may sound. This analysis I just gave you is not a Marxist analysis, although Marx wouldn't disagree with any of it. I can't help it if reality is radical. I didn't make it up that Nike pays them only 10 cents an hour. You say Nike pays them 10 cents. Well, you have a leftist perspective, or you have a left. I said, no, that's not a leftist. That happens to be reality. They are doing that. Some pundits and propagandists would label our desire to move in a rational direction and a peaceful reconstruction as weakness or folly or isolationism or dangerous pacifism. But we have another name for it. To wrest the wealth and power out of the hands of the military-industrial complex and the multinational investor class and give it back to the people so that they can become the agents of their own lives and social conditions, we have another name for that. We call that democracy, the victory of the republic over the empire. Democracy, and let's have more of it. We are so desperately in need of it. Thank you, brothers and sisters.
Michael Peretti, finishing up part two of a great talk from 1994, The Costs of Empire. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust wishing you illegitimi non carborundum. See you next week, and ciao.